Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, and today I'm very pleased to be joined by Professor Brian Vandermark, a professor of history at the United States Naval Academy, where he's been on the faculty since 1990. Welcome, Professor, to the War Room podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor Vandermark is a graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles, where he received his PhD in history, and he's also a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of several notable books, including American Sheikhs, Two Families, Four Generations, and the Story of America's Influence in the Middle East, and Pandora's Keepers, Nine Men and the Atomic Bomb. He also co-authored with the late Robert McNamara the national bestseller, In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, published by Times Books in 1995. He's here with us today to talk about his most recent book, Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent into Vietnam, which was just published by Custom House HarperCollins and has received some very positive reviews. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. Brian, again, welcome, and thank you for joining us. And I wanted to start the conversation by quoting something you write in the prologue of your book, where you identify the fundamental question that motivated the book. You say, "These were the men of the Kennedy administration, extraordinarily bright and able. Their judgments and decisions on Cuba and Vietnam, more linked than commonly assumed, make them appear blind, slow, and altogether inadequate in dealing with problems that inflicted terrible suffering on millions of people. It is an unnerving puzzle." And you continue, and here's where you phrase that question: "How and why did such intelligent and patriotic men not only make such unwise decisions, but continue to make them? And what are the implications of their experience for the process of decision-making generally?" So my question for you, which is a broad one, but How well do you think you answered that question in, you know, when you finished the book? How did you feel about your own answer to that question?
That's a very good question, Andrew. Let me answer it this way. I spent many years reflecting on that question. McNamara's memoir was published 23 years ago, and that was the last time I've written on the subject of Vietnam until this book was published. And I spent a lot of that time wrestling with that question, which is, how do you deeply explain the paradox of well-intentioned, patriotic, bright people making poor judgments that lead to so much suffering on the part of so many people? And I think by bringing in a lot of the insights of social science research combined with a deeper knowledge and understanding of the decision-making process itself, based on my experience with McNamara, his successor, Secretary of Defense Clark Clifford, and others, I think I've hopefully taken the explanation to a deeper level. There is no last word in history. There never will be, and I don't pretend to offer that. But I do hope that this book enables people to understand the paradox more deeply and more comprehensively.
So I think you've touched on a common error that I think human beings we make when we're considering how to make sense of a bad choice that someone made. You write later, whatever one's feelings about Robert McNamara, his role as Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War offers perhaps the prime example of how intelligent and well-intentioned individuals can make decisions that lead down the road to disaster. And this goes against, I think, what we call the attribution error, right? When somebody does something bad, the easiest and most comforting answer for us to why that happened would be that person is bad,
mm-hmm. you know, or ignorant,
right?
There's, or arrogant.
There's something wrong with them, and that's also comforting because I don't think that's wrong. That thing is wrong in me, so I can kind of distance myself from that mistake and, you know, say, yeah, McNamara, he was morally corrupt or wicked or whatever, and you don't offer that answer. Your answer is very different. But how are you able to avoid falling into that trap, right, of seeing this as a character issue?
Well, as I tried to explain at the beginning of the book, There are two pieces to this puzzle. One is the cognitive limitations of even very intelligent people, and McNamara is just as vulnerable to that as anyone else, including you and me. The other part of it is my personal relationship with him. He did not speak publicly about Vietnam for almost 30 years until his memoir was published, and I think it made people very interested in what he really thought and felt. And I was privileged enough to work with him and see sides of him that he never revealed publicly. And among many things, what was driven home to me was the fact that he felt the weight and burden and guilt of responsibility for poor decisions very intensively. It's just that he was part of a generation contained and masked their emotions and maintained a stoic facade. And I think that misled many people into assuming he was what he was caricatured as being, which was a bloodless computer.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that he wasn't. And I quote several remarks that he made to me privately at the beginning and end of the book that illustrate that point. The other thing he told me once was, and I asked him, I said, Mr. McNamara, why did you remain silent for so long? And his explanation at the time made sense, but I understand the deeper insight of it as time has passed, which is whatever I said would change nothing, but would hurt someone.
Interesting.
And I think there is a lot of truth to that when you reflect on it. He can't undo what was done, and whatever he said about what had happened would hurt someone in some way, and therefore he thought it was wiser to maintain silence. Now, that doesn't excuse the silence, and I'm critical of him for not coming out against continued involvement in the war while not only he was Secretary of Defense but afterwards, but I'm referring here to retrospective comments on the war in the decades that followed that.
If I were to ask you, you know, we're sitting in an elevator in a very tall building, so we'll give you a little more time. But I'm like, okay, so how did this happen? I mean, what's the story? How did we go from having this desire to kind of help an ally at a reasonable cost to 500,000, I guess it was right at the peak, around
more than half a million
troops, soldiers, Marines, sailors in Vietnam.
Chasing people who would not be found.
Tens of thousands of American dead, as you say, hundreds of thousands wounded, and then the cost for the Vietnamese, millions. I mean, how does that happen? You know, what is the answer?
Well, Andrew, several people have asked me that question, and I have then and now will politely and diplomatically refuse to answer it, because it's a complex subject, and it's the primary reason that I wrote this book that's more than 600 pages long, because giving you a brief answer would exaggerate, distort, and caricature things that can only be understood and explained at some length.
Yeah. Although your answer in the book, you might be able to summarize in some sense, not with the facts of the case, but with the facts of human psychology. Overconfidence, for example, or, you know, your discussion of the commitment trap, right? Sunk costs, you know. It seems, my view, I think sunk costs is currently informing U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. It really ought not to inform U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, but it does. And which raises an interesting question of how do you get away from this? You know, how do you pull out of this?
Well, I think one of the most important things to absorb is the point made by social science research and that I develop in the book, which is high intelligence is no protection against cognitive error. And the likelihood of cognitive error increases with the complexity of the problem you address.
Yeah.
And Vietnam is as complex a problem as has ever existed in this nation's history when it comes to foreign policy and national security affairs. I think that how do you protect yourself against that? It's impossible to immunize yourself to those cognitive limitations, but the irony is you're much more likely to mitigate their negative effect on you as to the degree that you are aware that you're vulnerable to those kinds of mistakes. Self-awareness and self-reflection is the antidote to a significant degree to those problems. They won't guarantee you that you'll fall victim to them, but they will lessen the likelihood that you will. And in all honesty, I think your ability and my ability to see that is enhanced by the fact that we are outside of that decision-making dynamic, which, as we've already discussed, is so frenetic, is so pressure-filled, and it leads to decisions that almost inevitably are based on incomplete information and yet very often have consequences in terms of their effect on lots of human lives.
And your point about not being able to immunize yourself against this, but perhaps developing some remedies for it through the structure of a decision environment or the kinds of people you bring in your organization. What did your research tell you about that? You know, what you actually can do, because you have lots of examples in the book of
what you shouldn't do.
What you shouldn't do. The book is full of really good examples of failure, which I think are highly instructive. So then the next question is, all right, so how should I think about this? Your point about self-awareness as well, that sounds wonderful. How do I improve that?
Right. I'll give you some specific examples. When you're on the threshold of making an important decision, I think one protective measure is to stop and ask yourself and those who are deliberating with you on a decision, what are my assumptions? How valid are those assumptions? When were those assumptions first defined, and in what way have subsequent circumstances perhaps challenged the validity of those circumstances? What do I really know about a situation or an issue? What do I really control about a situation or an issue? What consequences should I consider not tomorrow or next week or next month, but a year, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road? And it's much more difficult to do those kinds of things when you're in the midst of the pressure cooker of decision-making at the White House or the Pentagon or the State Department.
Yeah, and it can be very hard, actually, to identify those assumptions. So your point about asking others, that's great, because sometimes they're better. Assumptions when I talk to students about this, a metaphor I use is the smell of your own house. You know, when you sometimes come back home after a long trip and you notice this smell that you're thinking, does it always smell like that? Have I just filtered it out because it's so familiar? And what does my house smell like to somebody else? I think assumptions are kind of like that. It can be almost impossible for us to see them ourselves because they are so fundamental, so close to us, and so familiar. Yet at the same time, the power dynamics, I think, in the national security decision environment might make it very challenging for others to identify those assumptions.
And very often, assumptions that may have a particular merit at the beginning of a process, with changing circumstances, lose their relevance or validity, oftentimes to the point where they can become actively counterproductive. And I'll give you an example that I mentioned in the book, which is this perception that became almost dogma on the part of national decision makers concerning the monolithic nature of communism. At the beginning of the Cold War, at the end of the 1940s, there was a lot of truth to that in the late 40s and early 50s. Moscow had a tremendous degree of influence and leverage over most communist parties elsewhere in the world. And the Soviet Union and China did have a military alliance in the early 1950s. The problem with that assumption, which was relevant in the late 40s and early 50s, by the late 50s had become dangerously irrelevant. For example, the Soviet Union and China had a falling out of considerable importance that I think Washington was vaguely aware of, but they assumed, A, that it was either a ruse to make us complacent, or B, it didn't carry the import that it in fact did. And when you look at our involvement in Vietnam, the same kind of problem exists. Many decision makers inaccurately assumed that it was Communist China that was putting North Vietnam up to its aggression against the South. Because it's that assumption is conditioned by that larger assumption that communism is monolithic and
yeah,
it's all somehow
unified international movement, right?
Yes. And the reality was, ironically, both the Soviets and the Chinese advised the North Vietnamese to go slow in terms of their military operations against the South out of the fear that it would trigger American military intervention. So in a sense, they were acting as a brake on the North Vietnamese, but we could not see that or were not open to entertaining that possibility because of the blindfold of this unexamined assumption related to the monolithic nature of communism. And hindsight's always 20/20. It's a cliche, but there's a lot of truth to that cliche. It's more obvious to us now what the shortcomings and failures of these decision makers known as the best and brightest were. But that's why I keep coming back to the nature of decision making at the highest level. It is so pressure filled. It is so frenetic. It is so much a function of choosing among lesser evils rather than between an obvious, quote, right answer and an obvious, quote, wrong answer, that it makes it difficult to have the self-awareness, the self-reflection, the critical detachment that's necessary to identify what your weaknesses and vulnerabilities are.
What are some other ideas about Vietnam that you think are kind of persistent errors or myths that you address in the book?
Well, I think a very powerful one, which is also a very understandable one, is that it was a winnable war. And that's apropos of what you've just mentioned. And I think the reason that people hold so dearly to that belief is that America's military superiority then and now was so preponderant that there doesn't seem to be a sensible explanation for failure other than the fact that all this military superiority wasn't applied appropriately. And I think that the lesson of Vietnam is a very different one. It's not a question of how military superiority was inappropriately applied. It's a deeper and much more sobering conclusion that it was ineffective and irrelevant against an adversary whose advantages had nothing to do with military superiority. Their staying power, their willingness to make catastrophically large sacrifices, the fact that even though they were communists, they had earned the mantle of national legitimacy among the vast majority of the Vietnamese people. And our ally, whom we tried over and over and over again to build up as a viable alternative, never really got to the point where they could function in a viable way and appeal to their own people in a way which would allow them to stand on their own without our help. And I think that became abundantly apparent in 1975.
This idea of the winnable war, I think it appeals to us also because we prefer to think of the world as a place that we can really influence and control. Yeah, I think we want to believe that if we just do the right things, then it'll work out.
Well, you and I, and I think the vast majority of Americans, see ourselves as good people who mean well, whose intentions are honorable, and want to help to make the world a better place. And what is so sobering and earth-shaking for all of us is to contemplate the fact that even though we mean quite well and our conventional military capabilities are so preponderantly superior, in some instances that is not enough. And I think that is a lesson that most Americans do not like to confront.
When we reflect on the Vietnam War today, Vietnam is one of America's favorite historical analogies. It seems like it's almost always invoked in making sense of some current national security problem. If you're supporting a military intervention, then you're going to explain why it's not Vietnam. And if you're opposing it, you're going to explain why it is.
Yes.
How useful is that, right? I mean, like, what are the limits of that kind of analogy? Because you know Vietnam really well, right?
Well, so there is no perfect analogy between the past and the present. I think President Obama's comment about the fact that you never step in the same stream or riverbed twice is true, that the circumstances cannot be perfectly analogous. But that having been said, the dynamics at work in terms of decision-making and the application of military force can be soberingly similar. And I do think in that respect, Vietnam has a lot to teach us. And I think the reason it has a lot to teach us is you learn far more from your failures than you do from your successes.
But we like to think a lot more about our successes.
Well, of course, that's human nature.
And I think the Second World War in particular is this event that looms so large in the consciousness of the U.S. military. We are the good guys, you know, the nation is unified behind the conflict.
We're battling evil and we won.
Right. Yet history is full of lots of other kinds of wars, and conflicts like Vietnam are based on my, I would say, non-professional reading of history, much more common. Right, these limited conflicts where there's a lot more ambiguity, even in the short span of American history, we've been caught up in those far more frequently.
Yes. Well, I think that you take World War II as the paradigmatic example of an American war. I think the reason that many Americans view it in that fashion is that it reinforces our self-image and an awareness of what we do right and our capabilities. And those capabilities were applied in a fashion that was very effective in the Second World War. But you can also look at our own history further back in a different light and offer lessons that are very powerful. For example, if you look at the American Revolutionary War, the Continental Army under Washington effectively did to the British what the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong did to us in Vietnam. In other words, Washington, after the first year of the war, after the Battle of Long Island, his retreat from New York down through New Jersey into Pennsylvania, he was giving the British battle on their terms, fighting a conventional war which played to their advantages. And he got smart, because if he hadn't gotten smart, he would be dead. And he essentially went asymmetrical on the British by, instead of doing that, choosing where, when, and how long to fight the British, and as a result of that, controlling his casualties, drawing out the conflict, inflicting a steady stream of casualties on the British, making them question the endeavor over a long period of time, which is powerfully similar to what happened to us in Vietnam. And in some respects, most Americans missed that lesson because it was further back in our history, and it would require us to see ourselves in a way which was not consonant with the narrative that most Americans operated by in the mid-20th century, which is we are powerful as well as good.
Yeah. And we often think of military history, our unit of analysis is battle, which can be very misleading.
Yes.
I mean, there are so many examples of generals, armies that are extraordinarily successful in battle, yet fail to achieve their objectives. Hannibal in the Punic Wars against Rome, Robert E. Lee, for that matter, you know, and then, of course, the United States in Vietnam. And, you know, the battle is, it's a discrete thing. And of course, you can make like a diorama of it and move pieces around on a map, and we send our students to Gettysburg every year, and it's fascinating.
Well, it was, and probably to some degree still is, the paradigm by which the American military defines success in war. And I think the reason that is so is that in the Civil War and World War II, battles were the determining factor in the ultimate outcome. But that's because we were dealing with adversaries in terms of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan who would give us battle.
Yeah.
The problem is battles become irrelevant if your opponent is savvy enough not to participate in them.
Yeah, there's a great book I read last year by, I think his name's Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy. It's called The Men Who Lost America. And it's almost the best and the brightest from the perspective of the British military and political leadership during the American Revolution. So he talks about Lord North and George III and all the others, right? And some of the Howe brothers and mm-hmm. key figures in the war. And it is fascinating. I was struck by how, from their standpoint, in many ways, they were dealing with, I think, many similar problems. Now, of course, the American Revolution is interesting because, unlike the Vietnam War, the British and the American people shared a sort of common cultural heritage and so on. But nevertheless, the fundamental challenges you identified waiting them out, right? Mm-hmm. Yet in our minds, the Revolutionary War, even that war we talk about in terms of battles, Saratoga, Yorktown, right? Is it hard for us to think about strategy in conflict not being dependent on battles?
Well, I think that if you look at the Battle of Yorktown, for example, which is the final big military engagement that will lead to the Treaty of Paris ending the Revolutionary War, you and I tend to view it as a scenario in which Cornwallis is compelled to surrender to Washington and the Continental Army. What most Americans miss is that there were a substantial number of French troops at Yorktown as well.
Plus the French Navy.
And French Navy prevented Cornwallis from being evacuated.
Yeah.
And Cornwallis, because of those two factors, refused to surrender his sword to Washington or any officer of the Continental Army because, in his opinion, it wasn't the Continental Army that brought him down. It was the French Army and Navy that had done so. But you and I overlook that. Americans don't see that part of Yorktown because it doesn't fit with the self-image and the narrative of the United States and its military history.
Pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
Yes. And I think that there are lots of paradoxes in history in general and wars in particular. We're all familiar with this concept of the tyranny of the weak and the paradox of that, how the tail can wag the dog. Our South Vietnamese ally, in many instances, was the tail that wagged the dog. Its corruption, its incompetence, its dependency, and frankly, its resentment about all of those vis-a-vis the United States created a dynamic in which we were so firmly on the hook to them that they made it difficult for us to get out toward the end of the war. It wasn't the North Vietnamese that made it difficult. It was our own allies. And in a sense, if you were in their shoes, you would behave in a similar fashion. And I think another paradox is one that you and I are seeing played out with great frustration in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, which is you can be the 800-pound gorilla in the modern military world, and it will not get you your objectives in all war scenarios. And I think the reason for that is that just because you have the muscle doesn't mean that you're going to be decisive in terms of consequences, especially if you're dealing with adversaries who are intelligent and adaptive enough to figure out the answer is not to go toe-to-toe with a militarily superior foe.
Right. Avoid a decisive engagement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which we ourselves did when we were the 97-pound weakling in the Revolutionary War. But we forget that.
So in writing the book, was there anything in the story that you found especially surprising?
I think one thing that stands out in my memory is the powerful influence of wishful thinking on otherwise extraordinarily intelligent and well-intentioned people. And that applies to those in uniforms as well as suits. The tendency of the political leadership of this country during that era to indulge in and persist in wishful thinking in hindsight is remarkable.
Can you give me some examples of that wishful thinking at work?
Well, yes. In the first chapter of the book, I talk about the Bay of Pigs. And when you look back on the Bay of Pigs in hindsight, the fact that Kennedy and his advisors were operating on the assumption that landing 1,543 exiles in Cuba, A, could be kept secret, and B, would militarily prove decisive against Castro's regime, which had 130 times as many soldiers, is preposterous.
Yeah.
And yet they persisted in that illusion because of wishful thinking and their failure to question their assumptions and inexperience. And all of those dynamics will come into play in Vietnam.
It's sort of like we can't believe that this is what the people at this point actually want, Right.
Well, I mean, the power of wishful thinking is truly extraordinary because it can trump an assessment of reality, as you point out, especially if it's in conflict with your own expectations and assumptions.
I think wishful thinking was at work in our planning for the Iraq War as well.
Yes.
I mean, we meticulously planned the takedown of the regime, but everything after that depended on a series of assumptions that reflected a, in hindsight, really naive, but at the time we could sort of say very wishful assessment of the environment there, of what, how the people would react to us and how they would see us. And
yes, and I think that that process is one that affected decision-making on Vietnam. It affected decision-making on Iraq. It's probably affecting decision-making on Afghanistan today. And I regret to say that we'll continue to affect human decision-making in the future. You can't prevent these vulnerabilities and cognitive frailties. But what I point out in the book is you can minimize them to the degree that you become aware of them. And that's why I think self-awareness and self-criticism and introspection is so very important on the part of people who have power over the lives and deaths of other individuals. And yet those qualities are not rewarded or encouraged at that level of decision-making. Most people who reach that level of decision-making, shall we say, have a very healthy self-impression.
That's a polite way to put it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you're right. You reach the level of a four-star general or secretary of defense, and that's not the product of a series of career failures.
Indeed. So, and the irony, of course, is when you do stumble, it embeds in you a wisdom and a sense of limits and vulnerability that those who have not failed do not have. As I oftentimes point out to my students at the Naval Academy, the trauma is much deeper when it's inflicted on the quote-unquote golden boy than it is on someone who has stumbled along his or her way in life before. And yet it's the golden boys and girls that are usually pushed with great alacrity up the ladder to the point where they participate in this kind of decision-making.
Are there personal habits that you recommend to students that might help them cultivate that self-awareness? Because, I mean, my undergraduate training was in classics, and I still read classical philosophy. This is not a new question. I mean, there are a lot of ancient insights on this, but I'm curious about, you know, your perspective.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I wrote this book, as I mentioned in the prologue, is I want the students whom I teach, who are this generation of Americans' best and brightest, to internalize the lesson that is inherent in that saga, which is it's not the story of bad people making bad decisions. It's not the story of ill-intentioned people who are making bad decisions, or even those who are simply arrogant and ignorant. Very intelligent people carry inside their minds cognitive limitations that can have a profound effect on their decision-making. And what I try to get them to see is you too are the best and the brightest. And I think the implications of that should be obvious to everyone, which is you too consider yourself to be very intelligent, very well-meaning, very patriotic, and yet you too are capable of making grievously poor decisions. And if people let that sink in, then I feel as though this book is has some merit, and the teaching that I do has some merit.
So one last question I like to ask is, you are obviously a well-read guy. Do you have a book recommendation? And it can be on anything. It doesn't have to be pertinent to the subject of Vietnam, but for the audience, you know, a book that you've read maybe recently that you really enjoyed and would like to bring to the attention of the audience?
Well, it's going to sound a little presumptuous and probably predictable, but I think Tolstoy's War and Peace is a very good choice.
I don't think that was predictable at all.
Because so it's
a great recommendation.
It's a sustained meditation on human nature, the nature of war, the limitations and vulnerabilities of people caught up in that kind of a vortex. And I think reflecting on that is very healthy for people, particularly for those who are today and tomorrow are going to carry a lot of responsibility. It reminds them of the dangers that confront them, not just what they can do, but what they can't.
You know, in the defense and national security community, you often have to, like, persuade people that reading fiction is a worthwhile pursuit.
Yes.
Well, and I think fiction has the ability to cultivate in us good fiction. Okay. I'm not going to name names when I say we don't need to mention bad fiction. There's plenty of that out there. But good fiction, it can cultivate in us a greater self-awareness, something that you can't get from nonfiction. A great history is wonderful, but it doesn't allow you to inhabit the mind of another person, right? Because that has to be an imaginative leap. No historian can do that. Even in reading a great biography, you're not really doing that. But great fiction of the 19th century type, especially, mm-hmm. that's the golden age of the psychological kind of novel. In masters like Tolstoy or George Eliot, you know, you have this ability to inhabit someone else's life, to see the world from their perspective. That, I think, is a huge strategic asset.
It takes you outside of yourself.
Yes.
Which is so rare and yet so important. And it enables you to really fathom the human condition. And there's so much humanity to decision-making that the messiness of war, the unpredictability of war, the famous comment, I don't remember who made it, that the only thing you control in a war is the first shot. I want people who have the responsibility for war and peace decisions to recognize those realities, and you're much more likely to perceive and internalize them when you see them recreated in a world that you can inhabit in a novel like Tolstoy's.
Great. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure, Andrew.
I want to remind our listeners, so the book is Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent into Vietnam by Brian Vandermark, published by Charterhouse HarperCollins. It's available now wherever fine books are sold. I just wanted to say that, but of course on Amazon and elsewhere. Highly recommended. It's wonderfully written, actually. I would have loved to hear about your favorite historians from a style standpoint, because I'm a huge fan of just great style. It was beautifully written.
Thank you, Andrew.
Nice job. Highly recommend it. Pick it up. And thank you for joining us in A Better Peace.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.